Welcome to another episode of Systematic Geekology. This is a space where we seek to create and cultivate healthy conversations between those things we geek out on and the philosophical and theological questions that often arise out of our fandoms. Like, what does it mean to be human? What makes a hero? What makes a villain? How do the stories and narratives we geek out on shape how we live in the world? We are your priest to the geeks. We aren't all ordained, but we see ourselves as mediators at the intersection of geek culture and going deeper in our faith. We don't always have to agree, but we do respect each other, and we see everyone as a beloved child of God. Everyone geeks out on something, so come geek out with us and enjoy the show.
You're listening to an Anna's Owl Ministries podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Atlanteans, bubbling archaeologists, and mercenaries of all ages, we welcome you to the wonderful world of Walt Disney's Animation Studios. Today, we are focusing on Atlantis, the Lost Empire. I'm your host, Christian Ashley. This is Systematic Geekology. We are the priests of the geeks. I am joined today by two wonderful co-hosts. Of course, you know her, you love her, the better half of the Erdleys, Barbara Erdley. How are you doing, Barbara?
I'm doing good.
Does John listen to these?
He does. He's creeping in the other room right now.
Okay, good. I can't wait to hear his reaction to that later on. And of course, so much better than John. I mean, miles, leagues above John. A wonderful person through and through.
I'm you even know older him, than him.
You love him. Yep. You want to be him. TJ, how you doing, TJ?
Good. You know, my real middle name is John.
Well.
It's not. He lies.
Secret. Don't tell anyone.
Yeah, we'll never tell your name. That's probably been revealed multiple times over. So with that in mind, guys, what have you been geeking out on recently?
Minecraft.
Same server?
Yeah.
Very nice. Barbara?
So I've recently gotten into watching Bridgerton, which is, I fast forward through all of the, you know, spicy parts. But I mainly watched it because I love basically like period dramas, kind of. Where it's like, I love the costuming, I love the history and stuff like that. Like my favorite movie actually is Ever After, a Cinderella story. It's like the period, which is like correct and stuff like that. It's really interesting for me.
Very nice. Yeah. I'm continuing like this new TV has been like the greatest boon in the world just to have those free bells and whistles so I can have that Pluto app. And I've been switching between the MST3K channel and the Godzilla channel. And I fell asleep the other night to Godzilla versus Megalon. I got to see a giant beetle cockroach with team up with a giant chicken with, you know, buzzsaws against a giant lizard and Discount Ultraman. And it was a ton of fun. Like, it's something you could easily fall asleep to.
You don't mean Jet Jaguar.
That is Jet Jaguar, yes. Discount Ultraman.
Yeah. At least as cool as Ultraman.
At least as cool. Oh, spicy take. All right. So, guys, this is part of our Disney series, if you didn't know. As we go through all these different Disney films of different eras, we're moving on from what we've been doing. We're going to be in the post-Renaissance era for this specific episode. Then we're going to do some Pixar movies, some direct-to-video movies, you know, like Return of Jafar, stuff like that. We'll have the revival era, and then we're going to go into the pandemic releases. We're planning to do about three each in each of these. I know that won't hit all of them, but we'll get back to those we didn't hit later on. Like I said, this is going to be the first of our post-Renaissance era, and you can catch our Disney playlist in the links below. So, lady and gentlemen, how would you like to describe the story of Atlantis, the Lost Empire?
So, basically, small town archaeologist. I feel like all archaeologists are small town. Big town archaeology doesn't exist. Gets recruited to go on a mission. And that mission unfolds into much more than he was expecting, and the hidden city of Atlantis and its people who are still alive.
It's
the skeleton version. Yeah.
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 I always do that.
Yep, bare bones. You expect nothing less from TJ. He gives you exactly what you need. Not what you want, but everything you need.
I need them to go watch it. I got to give them just enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If this episode doesn't persuade you to watch that movie, we failed you utterly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you've never seen it before, this is one that deserves a lot more praise than it got. Just kind of got released in that era where things were going on in Disney itself, and it was released at the wrong time in the box office and just didn't get the buzz it rightfully deserved, much like another movie that I can't wait to get to. And if we don't cover it, I'll leave the show, Treasure Planet.
Of course, yeah.
I know we have plenty of fans amongst us. Then again, we were growing up with it, so that might help. So, guys, when did we first see Atlantis: The Lost Empire?
Good Lord, I was very young, I think. I can't remember. What year did it come out again? It came out...
2001?
Yeah, so I had been like 11 or 12. Because I first saw it when it first came out.
Yep, 2001.
2001. You're right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm thinking about the better movie. Treasure Planet.
Okay. TJ, when did you first see this movie?
Oh, I have no idea. I was three.
Really?
I was two when it came out. So,
I feel old.
There's no telling. I probably saw it when I was 4 or 5. The first time I remember, I was at daycare.
Okay. Because
we just had a bunch of VHS tapes. They were still releasing at that point.
Yeah. Barbara, does it make you feel old to know that Joshua at one point was a camp counselor while TJ was one of the students?
Yes. I just like I said, I saw it when I was 11 or 12 and I'm just like, that makes me feel so old because there are people out there who don't even know what a VHS is. And I remember, spending an afternoon going through my VHS wall, picking out the ones that need to be rewound and then setting them up for my sisters or my mom.
Yeah.
And it would take an entire afternoon. Yeah.
We did that. We were poor. So we still had VHS until 2010.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, I saw it around release, if not in theaters. My memory gets a little fuzzy after a while. I'm getting old. But I remember just being blown away by this film, by seeing the beautiful animation, the great set pieces of exploring the subterranean world. They got the very, because I had read Journey to the City of the Earth not long before this movie had come out. And it's the obvious parallels from Verne's work that they bring in here. So good. Such a great film. I can't praise this film enough. It's not my favorite Disney film of all time, but it's fairly high on the list.
Well, I remember playing the PlayStation 1 game that came out. I'm not sure how long afterwards it came out, but it's just being so excited that they actually made a playable, not like an RPG kind of, but a platformer based on a Disney movie. All the other ones are from a Game Boy perspective or something like that, but it's multi-level where it was just really exciting.
Yeah. The Bolt game was pretty good.
I don't think I've played that one, but I'm kind of getting back into a lot of the
the
Disney inspired stuff.
Excellent. So with all that in mind, guys, what is your favorite scene or moment? I put in the book in the outline because I cannibalized this from another one. In the movie is what I should have there.
It's so hard.
It is.
So much of this movie is just beautiful and meaningful and exciting.
Yeah, I'll give you one. Just give you guys some time to think. But it's the easy one. It's the Leviathan scene where, they got the buildup of them in this creepy part of the ocean. They've got to find this one spot where they can reach this cavern or something so they can go underwater for a bit to be lifted up to where there will be once more breathable land, but underneath the Earth's surface. And as they're doing that, they're exploring the area and you see the lights shine on all these ships that have been destroyed. And you're wondering, wow, what could have caused that? And Milo notes they're from every era possible. So that means whenever people sailed over these waters, the Leviathan came and got them. And as he's describing it in the book, talking about how it's mentioned in the Bible and all this, you actually see it. And it's this gigantic crustacean mechanical monstrosity that could easily destroy this entire ship. And in fact, destroys the big submarine they're all in. They have to flee into smaller ones just to get away. And none of their weapons that are advanced for the time, even noting the fact that this film has advanced in science many times past what it should be, but that's what it is what it is. And they barely make it away from it. Like, that is such a killer scene. It's, what do you guys
deciding,
think?
It's deciding, yeah. It's like, I understand that, yeah.
Sorry, I got distracted. I'm going to just watch the movie, like, immediately after. Open Disney Plus. God, it's so beautiful. Maybe, for me, it might be either the scene where they find out how to ride their, like, fish.
No. Mm. Oh.
They call them
vehicles,
the flying fish vehicles. Yes,
that was excellent. Or the kind of where they're trying to escape PETA and they're fighting for her in the flying fish versus, you know, man-made tech. I love that scene with the hot air balloon. Not enough action movies have like a good hot air balloon chase,
especially underground.
Especially
maybe underground. The only one of its kind.
So for both of you, it's more of an action scene. But I think for me, it was probably when Kida meets her, I guess you would call it her ancestors. Mm-hmm. And when she's rising up to actually, you know, have the spirit, like the spirits of her ancestors, I guess, not necessarily possess her, but like use her body as a catalyst. I feel like I'm really into like different mythologies and stuff like that. So like anything that has like a spiritual aspect to it, I always feel like is very strong. And I feel like the way they portrayed that, even though technically it got interrupted later because of course, you know, she's being sealed into a, I don't even know what it's made of. It's like a iron coffin.
Diving bell.
Something.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. But I just thought it was really pretty. At the same time,
it is. This is just slightly before the end of Avatar: The Last Airbender, which just reminds me a ton of like Kida's transformation, where he's doing like the energy. It looks so good.
Yeah, and one thing you noted, Barbara, was like the mythology and the world building they do for this, just this one movie.
Exactly.
Like they created an entire Atlantean language for this. That, you know, has its own rules and how it works. And that was a ton of fun. I definitely am not a linguist, as you can see from my Hebrew and Greek grades, but I can still appreciate when people put all that work into something like that. And then, of course, you got the whole mythology of how did Atlantis fall? What were they doing? Well, it turns out because Leonard Nimoy voices the king, responsible.
I forgot about that.
For all of this madness, because he effectively kind of used a crystal as like a nuke. And tried to remake the world in his image, create an empire of Atlantis, and that backfired on him. I love those so much, like, because number one, I just love world buildings, but like, and when you build that world, it makes it feel real. Yeah, I know this takes place in a real world, but with Atlantis added in, so give me that stuff. And this film does that amazingly. So I was very disheartened to see just how poorly it did in the box office later on, because I was a kid, I didn't know nothing about anything. So this film was obviously a success for me, not according to the box office.
Yeah, the only box office I really cared about was if the VHS box was in my daycare teacher's office.
Excellent. Yeah, I guess other scenes. I mean, there's just like the montage we get of them underground. It's not like the best in the world, but it's like you could see all these weird things that they're experiencing for the first time. You got the giant pyro firefly.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
That they just shine a light on, and oh no, everyone's gonna die.
So
then you've also got the nice character building scenes of Milo learning about who these people are, and them inviting him in, like choosing to make him part of their own crew.
So I appreciated the little humorous scenes too, because that's excellent character building. Yes. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. They do a really good job of making you like fall in love with the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it makes the toys to the betrayal feel real.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to think too, we're on a different set of questions, but who cares at this point? Like you've got what would be, if this were made today, it would be, guys, have you seen how diverse our cast is? Look at them. They're all different colors. And
that's true.
And there's also females there, too. And it's like,
two.
Why do you need to point that out?
Yes. Yeah.
Just like, show them on screen being people, explain who they are, mm-hmm. what they care about. And hey, look, these characters are pretty dang cool. If you don't just bring attention, like, hey, look, there's a different color than the other people you normally expect. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, she's a woman doing things a man would. It just, yeah. And for Audrey specifically, like, it brings up, hey, why are you a mechanic? You don't expect that. And then dad had two daughters. So he raised both of them pretty much like boys. So, hey, good character moment there. Nothing that would be like, I'm not even going to say what Hollywood would do. It's just like horrendous. It doesn't neglect the fact that these are people from different backgrounds and ethnicities and all that, but it also doesn't like put a spotlight on it too. And that's what I appreciate.
It's subtlety.
It's nuance.
Yeah.
Yes.
You used to be able to have a good motley crew and no one asked questions. Can't do that anymore because of woke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. it speaks a lot to like even just forgetting, you know, the fact that this is a creation of other people in our world. But for Mr. Whitmore, and like he doesn't care about petty things like, you know, race or sex or what have you. It's like, who's the best for the job?
Mm-hmm.
And he picked the best of the best. Like, that's how all bosses should kind of be. It's like, it doesn't really matter where you come from, what you do, as long as you are the best for the job. And I love how they play that in this film. Well, now that we've gone off track, let's get a little bit back on track by talking about favorite characters from the movie.
Mole.
Does anyone have one? Mole. Okay.
Mole. Mole's crazy.
I love Mole.
Yeah, Mole's me every morning.
Mole. I don't know why he's my favorite. He's the silliest, I think. But I don't know if you guys played Among Us, but
yes,
when it started growing, you could like buy like skins and stuff and little pets. Well, there was a skin that just looks like Mole and you can buy a little gerbil. So that was what my Among Us crewmate looked like.
Yeah. Mole's one of those. He's kind of a flat character for the most part, but he doesn't need to be fleshed out. And in fact, we are directly told not to learn about his actual history, which I think at one point in time it was just going to be revealed that he was raised by a bunch of naked mole rats or something like that. Citation needed. But yeah, I can agree with you. Barbara, you said sweet?
Sweet, yeah. No, I really like the scene where he's like explaining to everybody how to eat the fish creature or something they caught. Like, don't forget to eat the eyes. That's a good part. Stuff like that. It's just, he's so nonchalant about it. I love that.
Yeah, he is great.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Barbara. He is my favorite. Go ahead, TJ.
It's like the classic, I'm here, I'm going to enjoy it kind of guy.
Yeah. He's one of the ones we meet outside of Mole, who's like the first member of the crew outside of Helga and Rourke that Milo really gets to interact with. And it's like this hyperactive doctor who cares about his patient and asks all kinds of questions and just messes with him the whole time. It's like, it's obvious Milo's not saying anything, but he's responding to it like, you know, he's saying actual words. It's so funny. It's like just the way they troll him too. I enjoy that. But also like being sweet and, hey, sweet, as in like bringing him into the fold and like asking him his story and introducing his own great backstory. Your dad used to be in the army. I can't remember which tribe his mother's from. Just he's a product of that union, became a doctor, fought. Practiced medicine in the Spanish-American War. And if you don't know your history, like, you're just going to go, oh, San Juan Hill, what's that? You'll just move on with your life. But if you know the history, it makes it a lot better. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, a black doctor at that point in time would be a very big rarity. And yet it shows his competency that he would have been able to do that, especially a mixed doctor at that. Then, of course, later on, we get into the film when we get to Atlantis proper and the king gets attacked by Rourke and is soon to be dying. Who stays behind before everyone else, before even Milo? He has a patient. Mm-hmm. He's got the Hippocratic Oath, knowing he came down there for the money, which he says earlier on. He denies all that because he has a patient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's deep.
I'll go. Thank you. I tried to. Yeah. As far as other characters go, I do like Whitmore as well. He has a main presence in the beginning of the film, a little bit at the end where they're kind of just like, all right, so what happened? Let's get our story straight.
Mm-hmm.
But you get the kind of guy I want to be when I get old, just like doesn't care anymore what people think, just kind of does whatever he wants. and I have all this money so I can do whatever I want with it. And he chooses to be this eccentric genius who funds all these projects to find this ancient knowledge. Like, yeah, I want to be that when I grow up. And the
super
fun
rich.
Fact, you know, well, that too, that'd be nice. But fun fact, if you notice the aquarium that he has early on, there's a special fish there that if you know your biology, you know your cryptozoology, is called the coelacanth. And that wasn't discovered by, you know, mainstream European and American scientists until 24 years after the events of this film. So that shows you, it's just that small, subtle details of it. Oh, wow, this man's ahead of the curve. I just appreciate that immensely as a viewer. Like, the, you can get stuff like that on a second viewing and more. Yeah, make me want to rewatch a film.
Do you love systematic ecology as much as I do? Of course you do. So why don't you hop on over to the Systematic Ecology shop and get yourself some merch. We have clothing like hats, extra soft t-shirts, sweaters, hoodies. We even have glassware and mugs. One of my favorite coffee mugs that I use every morning is a coffee mug that has on it, share the faith, share the geek. Yeah, I get my geek on first thing every morning thinking of systematic ecology. And I know you need to hop over there and get you some merch, represent us out in the wild, out in the public, and let people know that you too like to share the faith and share the geek.
I really wish, you know, a small tangent, but I wish Relicanth had come out before we rediscovered the coelacanth. Would have been really cool. It would have been so funny. Like, wow, they based a real fish off of Pokemon.
A Gen 3 water rock. Yeah.
Bad.
That really bad typing and not a good mon, but it's still fun.
It is still fun.
Yeah.
It is.
We love Relicanth.
Anything else about characters, guys?
No, I think every character gets enough time. Like, they all get different amounts of time that, you know, in the spotlight, but it's enough for each character to feel fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
They do it so well.
Yeah, and we've got our main leads too, Milo and Kida. Like, Milo's one of those, like, dorky guys you kind of can get behind. He's so passionate about his project, and that doesn't work out for him the way it does. I see it.
And then, of course, you got
Kida. Oh, go ahead.
No, you're fine. I was just saying, what's funny is Atlantis is actually one of John's favorite movies. So it's like he likes it because he's personal self-insert.
It's a movie written for John.
It is.
Yeah. By John for John is what I meant to say. Then we've got Kida, who kind of has this weird pseudo canonicity in like the Disney princess scheme of things. You don't really see her alongside the other Disney princesses for reasons I can't fathom, other than like kind of like a long way with Black Cauldron. They kind of like, oh, well, you were a bomb, so we don't really care about you, even though both movies are spectacular.
Thank you.
And it's not their fault. Thank you. Yes. Both movies are great. It's not their fault they're bombed at the box office. It's more the viewer's fault than anything. And like, and she even becomes the first princess in lore who officially on screen kind of becomes queen.
That's true.
So like, why are we like not bringing her up to the forefront? Like, she's a great character in this film. Get on it, Disney.
No dress. Dress too small.
Well, I mean, you've got Jasmine.
Jasmine gets, like, her pants are big.
Okay.
What about Ariel?
So if you wear pants,
doesn't even have legs.
Rude, but she did get a dress.
That is true.
I'll admit that.
Okay. But we probably got to do an episode later on for a Disney princess free-for-all, like who's our favorite at some point.
Merida.
Merida's a good one.
Excellent. But we want to keep a little mystery if we ever do that. So we can't reveal everything here. All right. So as stated before, part of the backstory of this is that, you know, Atlantis was once this continent expanding empire that took over other regions of the world. And if you know your Atlantean lore, for people who study weird things like that, like me, you can also look at Friday Night Frights on our YouTube page that I did an episode on Atlantis for, the actual Atlantis, not the actual movie. You there's this thing of like, you know, about 10,000 years before, 8,000, depending on who's telling the story, Athens and Atlantis fought one another. And eventually, because of their sins, the gods pronounced judgment upon Atlantis, forced them down under the sea. And we kind of get a bit of that from a very interesting point of Kida's dad, whose name escapes me at the moment. I'll just call him Spock, who illogically, I should say, decides to feed a lie to them. It's like, from a certain point of view, he's kind of true in that they were punished for their hubris, neglecting the part where he played a huge role in that. And it wasn't so much the gods as in his own hubris coming back to destroy the entire country and make people forget they were ever really a thing. But it all comes to this point about how we utilize our natural resources. And their crystal, as far as we're aware, is the only one of its kind. It's something that offers immense power, but also at the same time, immense death. So what do you think this film is trying to say about utilizing our natural resources?
That's a really heavy question.
Mm-hmm.
I think the moral of the story is that Atlantis is cool.
Okay. As your,
also,
your
don't official... abuse your natural resources.
Yeah.
But it is, that's what the, I was about the to crystal say. Crystal is what saves them after being taken advantage of. So it kind of wraps back into itself, like, take care of your planet and it'll take care of you. That sort of thing.
I feel it's also a little bit of like, be aware of what's around you, because it's like, you know, you may not be able to restore your natural resources. If you use it too much, it's not going to come back, or at least for like a very, very long time. So then once it runs out, what are you going to do? It's not a good thing.
And Spock's position is also kind of like brought up with, shown as a foil towards what Rourke and Helga and the other crew initially want to do with it, is they're not thinking about, hey, this could be so good. Like, this grants pretty much almost everlasting life and all this. No, they're looking at it as something's like, instead of harmonizing it with nature, they decide, oh, we can make a profit off of it. Which, hey, there's nothing essentially wrong with trying to make a profit off of something. If you're doing it, you know, as morally and ethically as possible, this is definitely not that case. And as Milo rightly points out, this is taking place in the year 1914. Well, what else is happening around this time? World War I, we're not involved yet because we're a bunch of isolationist idiots at this point in time. But at that same time, he rightfully calls that, they're going to could probably even sell it to the Kaiser and make millions upon millions of dollars, bringing them a weapon that, hey, once again, almost destroyed the entire world because they refused to learn from their history. And I mean, you look at that, it's kind of a fantastic nuke in that sense. And as the only country in the world that has launched nuclear bombs on another sovereign nation, I think that's something we have to look back on and go, okay, now what do we do with that?
I think it ties into anti-militarism, wage not, want not. Mm-hmm. This wouldn't have happened to Atlantis if they weren't trying to expand, broaden their horizons, make enemies of their neighbors. I mean, Milo talks about how like ancient civilizations all over the world write about Atlantis. So this is clearly like Britain post or pre-Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And they pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And only by, you know, having their natural resources stricken from them and, you know, brought down to nothingness, they are able to, you know, be saved by Milo and then get access to that again.
Robert, anything you want to add?
Well, I was just going to say, by being stripped of like those resources, they were able to find other resources. Like once they're down below the earth, you do have to kind of adapt to, you know, they don't have anybody to trade with anymore. They don't have anywhere to expand. It's, if you watch the movie, you see they're basically stuck inside a, what looks like a caldera, kind of like on top of a old volcano. So it's like, you know, they have to fish for their own food. Granted, they're like really oddly shaped mutated lobster fish. But it's like, you know, it also shows like how civilizations can adapt when stripped of their resources. Like you have to learn new skills. You have to learn new ways of like finding food. And then it's like, you know, also the scenario of being thrust in a situation where now you do have those old resources again. Are you going to learn from your mistakes? Are you going to learn from your history? Or are you going to better yourselves by learning from history?
Yeah. And there's something you kind of made me think of in this, is that I think our King Spock here has kind of gotten to the point that's never not going to be funny to me.
King Spock.
Where he seems to almost be anti-technology in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that he, and anti-literacy too, so that the people don't know how to activate those things.
Yeah, like
anymore. Yes. Goodness gracious. As kind of a part of, well, I can't repeat the mistakes of the past if you don't know what you're doing, which I understand the logic behind it. But at that same time, that technology could be used for good. Like, you can use those ships to fly places. You could just strip the weapons of war from them if you really want to. Like, your people need to be literate so that they don't get scammed by other people, so that they know how to do basic mathematics and know how to read and what contracts they're signing. I mean, that's a huge reason why literacy is so, I mean, as important as it is. I mean, there's mm-hmm. plenty of others. But you notice, well, he controls the things, and Keita was a kid when this happened, you know, 8,000 whatever some years ago. So of course she doesn't know how to read. Of course, most of the Elanians there, even with their long lives, some of them probably died and just the knowledge was lost with them. Right. I mean, who knows what the king was doing to make sure that stayed around, but I'm not going to speculate on that. It's not a speculation podcast. So yeah, it just struck me as I was rewatching the film earlier and having this conversation, that there's kind of like, from his side of things, an anti-technology, anti-literacy thing based around him not overcoming his own hubris.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like, in a way, he's trying to keep everybody safe by doing that, where it's like,
yes,
if I keep them from learning how to read, if I keep them from doing these same mistakes, everyone will stay safe. It's like the fear of, not necessarily like the unknown, but it's like the fear of knowing what happened and the fear of it happening again if people don't learn, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, he has a very reactionary stance because, mm-hmm. you know, it ruined his life. And,
his life is gone.
That's that out of shame, at least partially. And, you know, I can't really blame him. I don't know if it's exactly rational for him to go like, well, I know how to make sure no one knows. I'm not going to teach anyone how to read ever again.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, and I noticed I skipped over a question. I'm so on fire today, guys. Let's go back a bit. Animation. What do you think is like the best example of it in this film?
There's so much.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's
possibly a the Leviathan thing.
Okay. That's a good one.
There's a little stretch where they're in the big sub. And up until the Leviathan scene is all extremely gorgeous. Man.
The fireflies. That's a good one. Like, everything catches on fire.
It's nice and hectic, and mm-hmm. you don't know what's going on exactly. You're panicked just like they are in the scene. That's a great one. And the Leviathan scene too, cannot agree more. It's like so well animated, so it's like menacing. It's like, how are they supposed to get out of this one? And they barely even do that, and not even all of them do.
Yeah. Atlantis resurfacing, gorgeous.
Hmm.
Or
emerging. From the volcano,
from the lava, like,
with the barrier up. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, whatever. Thank you for the correction. I'll go with the climatic battle, as in very well animated. Like, you've got all this going on. They've got their own little planes that they just bring up out of nowhere. How did that survive from the ship? Don't ask questions. Just accept it. And the hot air balloon, how did that make it? Don't worry about it. Just accept it. They didn't know that there would be some mystical place where they could just, you know, shoot a rocket up towards the Earth and that would bring them out. But you know what? Don't worry about it. But still, the fight scene of them on the Atlantean ships, the gun battle mm-hmm. down there, as they learned, oh, well, these things kind of have weapons too. That's pretty cool. And like the clashes between Rourke and Helga and Milo and Rourke, and him shattering into a million pieces. To that extent, or zillion, as I think Mole says. Oh, maybe it was Cookie. Who knows? Yeah. So well done.
So well done. It's gorgeous. I don't know. I am watching it right this second. Just the scenes in Preston's house. They're so beautiful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Like the reflection coming off of his Relicanth aquarium.
Yeah. So moving on from there. Unless you guys have something else you want to add. All right. Silence says all. A criticism that's kind of been levied against this film is that it propagates the white savior or Mighty Whitey trope, in that Milo ends up becoming such a savior for the Atlantean people. He's the only one who knows their language. Like, he's the one who brings them back on their feet. Like, how accurate do you think this criticism is in the movie?
Not very. I mean, he's a nerd. No offense to nerds, but it's like, you know, when you think of like the white savior person, like, at least for me, maybe it's a woman thing, but you always think of like somebody who's like fuller stature, taller. I mean, he's a linguist. He's not like, he doesn't just exude hero complex, kind of, when you think about it.
It does feel kind of nerd savory, but I can understand the white savior angle.
Yeah.
I feel like it's not, because it thematically it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I do understand the frustration.
I get where people are coming from, but at the end of the day, like, if you look at the film's context, well, of course he's the one who's able to save them, because he's the only one who's been studying it these past couple of years.
Yeah.
Like, they don't know their own language anymore. They don't know how to use the materials and technologies around them, because it's been stripped from their minds, essentially. The ability that they could even think, oh, wait, maybe we should use these relics. Or maybe they're just statues that just walk around and go like, oh, that's a weird looking hammerhead shark thing there. Or maybe they don't even know what a hammerhead shark is at this point in time. So Milo coming in that way to save the day doesn't really offend me that much, because it makes sense within the parameters built by the story.
Mm-hmm.
He's not coming there as being like, oh, you savages, you just don't know what's good about the world. Let me introduce civilization to you. And it's like, no, it's him trying to mutually understand and reciprocate that understanding, like in the scene with him and Kida. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like I have everything. I'm the one with the questions here. You better answer me. It's like, no, let's learn about each other in this scenario. So once again, I understand where it's coming from, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same.
Yeah. Well, do you guys have anything you want to add to this discussion before we get to the representation of Atlantis throughout Disney's history?
Gorgeous movie. Can't say that enough.
Excellent movie.
Probably second or third most gorgeous movie in the post-Renaissance era. Not the first, but...
Barbara?
Overall, I loved all the different little nuances throughout the movie. Like, the humor, the world building, like, how the characters just interact with one another. I love that. It's very hard to find not just a Disney movie, but like an animated movie that does that anymore. Either they just focus on like the main character, and then you have like a couple little side characters sprinkled in, but it's like you don't have more than like one or two fleshed out characters in a movie anymore.
I feel that. All right. So, funnily enough, because it was a box office bomb in many respects, I mean, finally, in a poor sense, Atlantis has had very few actual bits of representation in the Disney parks and in other media as well. Now, there was a proposed attraction that was going to be in the Magic Kingdom, specifically in the Adventureland slot. Mm-hmm. It was going to be called Fire Mountain. It would have been based around kind of the volcano and being used there specifically as a roller coaster of you going through the events of the film, which sounds pretty metal to me. I'm so sad it didn't make it.
Right.
But you know what? It's hard to get too wound up about something that happened 20 plus years ago. What? Well, not even that. Yeah, 20 plus years ago.
Make me feel
never
old.
Never trust me with math. So there were several reasons for why it never got to become a main attraction there. The underperformance of the film, like we mentioned before, something I learned about through this, and that there was a bit of decreased tourism to the parks post 9/11, which makes sense.
Yeah.
The movie came out in June, 9/11, a couple months later. So they just kind of scrapped some things with the less revenue they got.
Yep.
And go ahead, TJ.
I was going to say it's a lot like my little sister in that way.
Oh,
came
yeah.
out in June. 9/11 was a couple months later.
Like, coincidence?
Nope.
I think not.
I've been saying that for years.
Homeland Security. We know the door you need to break down.
Yeah. She killed Dale Earnhardt when she was in the womb, and after she got out, she just wanted to change the skyline.
Yep. Kept on killing.
They got to get her.
Does your sister listen to the show?
I hope not.
Well, I know you don't, so I didn't know if that was like a family thing or not.
No, I think they like podcasts.
Excellent. The other reason is that the CEO at the time, I believe he was CEO, Michael Eisner, had, you know, went to the brand new Universal Islands of Adventure around that time, which he had gone there directly to see, hey, they're going to be competition to us. Let's see what they're doing. Is there anything we need to be worrying about? And in his professional opinion, there was nothing they had to worry about. Mm-hmm. So he decided, yep, that's just another reason not to put it in there. So take that, Universal, I suppose. Then
a long way
around. Yeah. Initially, around the release of the movie, a couple months afterward, until the box office receipts came back, you could see both Milo and Kida as characters at Disney. But when those things started happening, they kind of quietly removed them from the cast list. So I think it was just less than a year they were around the park.
Lame.
And as far as, yeah, as other representation goes, Kida does appear briefly in a House of Mouse episode. I think that's riding on one of the mechanical fish.
That's really cool. Yep. I do know exactly where they should put Fire Mountain, but okay. It shouldn't be Fire Mountain anymore. There should just be an Atlantis, probably Dark Ride in Epcot.
Okay.
Okay. I could see that.
Oh, yeah. I think it would make sense. It would be very cool.
I like it.
Maybe replace the Nemo Aquarium.
It's time for a rebrand. Put it among the other countries of the world. You know, you've got Norway, you've got Japan, you've also got Atlantis.
That would be really cool. That would be really fun.
Real places.
If they were
I think that would be awesome.
Undertake it, if they could like put it in the lake.
Oh, that'd be perfect. Like right in the center of the lake.
The lake. They can do it.
Okay, now we're really increasing costs.
I'm like trying to imagine that. That would be awesome.
They could definitely do it.
If any company could afford to do it, the question is, would they want to? Yeah. All right. So we've spoken about the film. Guys, we're going to have a bonus question about this one. And if you're interested about that, you can join us on Patreon or Captivate. So all our Patreon and Captivate listeners who send us that money that way are able to listen to all our bonus questions. And this one in specific, we're going to talk about the sequel just a little bit and how in direct video sequel, we see the team kind of becoming these adventurers and explorers, detectives of a sort, as they investigate several mysteries that includes like a Lovecraftian town, a Native American wind spirit that they encounter, and the actual prevention of Ragnarok itself. So we're going to ask what other mysteries of history and the supernatural would we have liked to have seen them investigate if that show had actually become more than a direct-to-video sequel. So with that in mind, guys, ratings, review, what do you think? Scale of 10.
Easy that's 9. That's a tough one. Easy 9. 9?
Okay.
9.5.
Okay. Barbara?
I did not enjoy the sequel as much as the first one, but I think it was...
No. We're not talking a sequel. We're talking actual movie. Sorry.
The actual movie? Okay. The actual movie, I would probably give probably a 9. Yeah. I really enjoyed the first one.
Yeah. I'll stick around my fellow hosts here. I'm giving the sucker a 9.5. Yeah. Do I have some gripes along the way? Sure. But mostly at the end of the day, it's a grand spectacle. It's a great mystery. There's a lot of intrigue there. Good characters to follow. Great world building. This is a movie that deserves better than it got. And I know a lot of people are starting to appreciate it a little more now in hindsight. But man, if only it succeeded then, it would have been so much better. So that's it for that. Guys, do you have a recommendation for the audience?
That's not Atlantis.
It's not Atlantis. No Valorant, no Minecraft.
Jujutsu Kaisen is getting pretty close to ending. And it's time. If you pick it up now, you'll probably catch up. If you read it like a normal person, you'll probably catch up right when it ends. If you're reading it.
That sounds fair. Barbara?
Well, we're doing a year of anime with our kids. So we've been bouncing back and forth between a couple of different animes. Right now we're going through Indigo League for Pokemon. It's a very tried and true oldie, but I'll recommend that one.
Okay. Very nice. Yeah, I didn't know we were all going to pick something anime related. I'm picking something Atlantis and anime related. That being Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water. Came out in the 90s. Studio Gainax, same people who did Evangelion, Gurren Lagann, all that. Tremendously good show. You've got your Verne style as well, because it's heavily inspired by, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Journey to the Center of the Earth, so many others that he did, but with your typical anime stuff happening as well. It's really fun. Just skip the filler if you want to preserve your life. Some people don't make it through, and I don't blame them because that's kind of soul-sucking. So just skip the filler, you'll be fine. So with that in mind, guys, thank you for listening to this episode. Had a ton of fun doing this one. We love our Disney series. We love talking about stuff like this. So please, if you get a chance, just leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice to help us with the ratings there. Also, as well as a reward for getting us to 100 plus subscribers on YouTube, we are going to be doing eventually a special Q&A where as many hosts as possible are going to join. So please send your answers, your questions our way. Yeah, send the answers. We'll figure out the question. That's gracious, what is wrong with
that?
You?
Would be fun, though.
If they send the answers, we'll do a, and we come we'll up do a, with the question.
Well, yeah, we'll do a bonus episode on that if you send answers. So send your questions on either our Facebook page, Priest of the Geeks, or Discord. Join us there. We've got an episode discussions channel where you can just put it right there. But if you just want to email us directly, do systematicgeekology@gmail.com. We'd love to have your questions that we can answer as many of us as possible. And maybe some of us will even speak eloquently at that time. I know I won't be one of them, but I'll still be there. So thank you as well to our patrons, Aaron Hardy, Daniel Sigmund, Trip Fuller, James Barrett, among several who do a lot of incredible work for us. Thank you very much. But remember, guys, we are all a chosen people, a geekdom of priests.
If you love our show, you can follow the whole network in a single feed on Spotify at Anna Zahra Ministry Podcast or the network page on Apple Podcasts. There you'll find shows like The Homely, The Whole Church Podcast, My Seminary Life, Let Nothing Move You, Dummy for Theology, The Bible After Hours, as well as mine and my husband's show, The Clives, where my husband Taylor and I go through weekly discussions in a devotional conversational method to help us all get closer to one another and God.
If you'd like to support our show, please consider joining our Patreon, where you get live access to our YouTube exclusives, including our comic book ketchup, manga mustard, drinks with Tejas, and our companion series that we do each year with our annual theme. You can also get exclusive merch, including t-shirts, handbags, a coffee mug, and a long sleeve shirt. We also have available bonus extra questions at the end of most of our podcast episodes. You get access to exclusive Discord channels, discounts on our store, access to any future online D&D campaigns. You get to vote on topics for some of our episodes. You can easily access all of the Patreon content right through Spotify now. So super easy. Go to our Spotify page at the top. It's going to say exclusive content for subscribers. If you're a patron, hit that button. You get all of our bonus content right there on Spotify, right with your regular feed. And of course, you get the satisfaction of knowing you helped a podcast in need. Our overhead includes editing software, marketing equipment, recording software, and a lot more. And there's a lot that goes into keeping the lights on here. And we really appreciate all of our patron subscribers for helping the show happen.